Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network with Connect the Dots. I'm a longtime health, food, and environmental journalist covering these topics currently on Alternet, the Huffington Post, and intentblog.com. Look there for my articles connecting the dots between all facets of our personal health and our total health environment. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different authors, experts, advocates, leaders, scientists about all of the many facets of our world that affect us, our health, our future, and our children's future and life on Earth. And, you know, sometimes we kind of go for overarching system-wide themes because we're taught in the health world to look at individual solutions, to look into our microbiology, but very all too often we don't look further into the health of our society or the health of our world, the total environment that impacts every one of us as well as future generations to come. And today I'm really thrilled to have one of our big picture themes, but that's also concrete and that people can really participate in and do something about, which is another ongoing theme of our show. On today's show, we're going to be talking about what women can do and are doing to protect the Earth and address climate change so that we all have a future. Human life and many different species have a future here on planet Earth in a time of environmental destabilization brought about by man-made activities. We've covered this topic many times before, but this month is particularly timely because of an exciting upcoming summit, which we'll learn more about on the show, because the founder of it is here with me today and to talk with us on Connect the Dots. Her name is Asprey Oriel Lake. She is the founder and co-director of the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, which is holding an upcoming summit north of New York City the weekend of, it's actually a little into the week too, the dates of September 20th through 23rd. That's just this month, not too far away. So she's going to tell us all about that. She is also the author of a Nautilus Award winning book called Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature. Wow, what a great thing to be covering. That really says so much, and we're going to learn more about it on today's show. So welcome so much to Connect the Dots, Asprey.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So happy to have you here. And listeners, I will be attending the upcoming International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative and reporting on it, and you can attend too as you learn more in the show. So first off, let's just, you know, talk a little bit about the purpose of the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, which you founded.
Yes, and I also have brought on board with me, just to mention, a co-founder with me, Sally Ranney, who will also be at the upcoming summit. And the thing that we're really focusing on is the fact that we know that we're at these really critical tipping points, as I'm sure you know and a lot of your listeners know, with our environment. And about 4.5 years ago, I started something called the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus, which was really brought together to see what women could do about climate change and environmental degradation. And over the years, it's built towards really seeing this as an opportunity for an international global women's movement on climate action. And we've decided to put together this incredible summit that's coming up, as you said, September 20th to the 23rd, to really lift up what solutions women are looking at. And in particular, the thing that we've become very excited about, and I began doing this research, as I said, about 4.5 years ago, something I didn't know when I wanted to sort of jump into the climate justice movement, is how women really are key to solutions, and at the same time, they're most negatively impacted by climate change and environmental degradation. And so we thought, you know, this is really an opportunity for women to take action.
Fascinating. Why is it that women are more acutely impacted?
Well, a lot, especially in developing countries, we see, you know, women are on the front lines of collecting their food and water resources and growing the food. They're at the home with the children. They're also more vulnerable when a lot of these impacts come, they're often the ones that are in the homes and the ones that are being able to be responsible for their communities. And so this puts them in a great disadvantage, but at the same time, as I was saying, you know, not to portray them as victims. They're also more vulnerable, but they're also really key to solutions because, as an example, when you look at a lot of United Nations studies, you see that in developed countries, 60 to 80% of all household food production is done by women. When we are looking at a lot of these attempts to create different programs for water and helping women, especially again in developing countries, have access to water, if you don't involve women in those programs, they simply don't work because women have the knowledge about where the water is in their communities. At the same time, you know, going back to the negative impacts, women do most of the water collecting in developing countries, and when you are seeing these huge droughts that we're experiencing all over the world, women are having to walk further and further for their daily water needs, sometimes even up to, you know, 5 to even 8 hours a day it can be spent collecting water. I mean, that's really extreme if you imagine. I know it's hard for us to imagine here in the United States, if you spent, you know, a good portion of your waking hours collecting water, what would that do to your life? I mean, it's quite extreme and very real for some women in their communities now in Africa and India. At the same time, I think what's really important to understand, too, is that when we're looking at some of the foundational principles of sustainability, if you really want to get at issues like population, that's all about educating and empowering women. We know that if you want economies to improve, that you need to educate and empower women. And we know from a lot of different studies that when women are in decision-making positions, environmental laws are improved a great deal. So it's a very interesting mix of seeing how women are really at the forefront of a lot of these problems, but they're also really essential to the solutions. So we're looking at, you know, how do you lift up women's empowerment in this critical climate crisis. Another point I'd make also is that in North America, 80% of all consumer purchases are decided by women. That's a really big number, and one of the things that we're looking at is, you know, can we imagine how that market power could be mobilized to significantly reduce carbon emissions through purchasing choices of women, including demanding an end to fossil fuels. So we're really looking at all these different aspects and entry points for women to really make a change at this amazing time when we've really got to change our trajectory around our carbon reduction emissions.
And so, you know, what will be going on at the summit? First of all, you know, who's attending? And second, what will you be, you know, doing there that will really move this initiative forward?
Well, we're really excited about the delegates who are coming. It's really quite a thrilling lineup. I've been working on a lot of these invitations for actually about a year and a half, up to 2 years, to really look out into the international community and say, you know, who are some of the leading women that are taking action, who are leaders, who have large constituencies. And I'll tell you, we limited it to approximately 100 participants, including guests. And some observers, and we wanted to do that one, so we ourselves were not having a huge carbon footprint by bringing everyone together, and also to really be able to have a more intimate conversation. And it was very challenging because we could have had 1,000 women. I mean, there's so many incredible leaders now in communities around the world doing amazing work on climate and environmental sustainability issues. So to mention some of the ones that will be coming, we're very honored that Cristiana Figueres, who's the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, she will be attending. Marina Silva, the former Brazilian Minister of the Environment, Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jody Williams, marine biologist Dr. Sylvia Earle, May Bovey from 350.org, who's the executive director of 350. One of the people that signed on early who's been a real inspiration to me is Vandana Shiva from India, who's a very powerful environmental activist and physicist. Melina Labakan-Massimo, she's a wonderful indigenous and environmental activist from Canada who's working on the tar sands campaign. Naomi Klein, a very well-known author and activist from Canada, and then a lot of leaders from really key organizations that have been working with women in climate change for many years. As an example, the Global Gender Climate Alliance, UN Women, Women's Environment and Development Organization, who's been there for many, many years, you know, back to which began back in the first Rio Plus 20 summit in 1992, 1 million women from Australia, the NAACP is going to be sending representatives, and just a lot of indigenous and grassroots women leaders from all over the world, from the Amazon forest, from the Congo. I mean, it's going to be quite an amazing group of women that we wanted to do, you know, sort of a big cross-sector analysis, which meant we needed to invite a lot of grassroots women, indigenous women, as well as high-level policymakers. We have women in business coming who are working in solar technologies and wind technologies. And that's one of the things that's really unique about the summit, is it's really bringing together many different women from different professions so that we can have a holistic view and look at many different entry points around solutions concerning climate change. And one of the big objectives that we're looking at during this 3.5-day summit is drafting together what we're calling a Women's Climate Action Agenda, which will be a very detailed report outlining what all these experts that we're bringing together think are the most critical areas that we can gain traction on at speed and scale at this time. And really, in essence, what we know is that national and international responses of governments to runaway climate change and to the root causes of this crisis are really not equivalent to the escalating urgency of the situation and what nature is also reflecting back to us. So we feel that there's also a terrific need for urgency, and that's one thing about this particular cohort of women is they've been working in this field for a long time. So we have an ambitious agenda for sure, but I think this outcome document of a women's climate action agenda is going to be extremely valuable, you know, for grassroots organizations, for governments, for people involved in this movement to really see what kind of demands women are making who are on the front lines of climate change.
Just highlight a bit for our listeners, if you would, Osprey. You know, when you speak of the urgency, you know, many of the people that I know and talk to will be aware of the issue, and yet there is a sense that it's, you know, 200 years off. It won't affect me in my lifetime. You know, we still have time to solve this before any untoward effects are experienced. And this is even with, you know, for example, I'm on the East Coast, Occupy Sandy, and you know, Hurricane Sandy and all the rest of Katrina and all the rest of it. If you wouldn't mind, just to do a short recap for people about where we are in terms of the urgency that you feel.
Well, I think that one of the things that we need to understand that at this point, very unfortunately, global temperature rise of 1.5 or 2.0 degrees Celsius is pretty much, by many scientists, has been said to be already locked into the atmosphere from greenhouse gas emissions to date. Mm-hmm. A good way of looking at that, which we know will we've already seen, as people on the East Coast know from Superstorm Sandy, can create these extreme weather events that we've been experiencing not just here in the United States but all over the world, with extreme droughts and, on the other hand, extreme flooding that has already impacted so many people around the world, affecting food supplies, affecting access to water and water security. Right now, we're actually on course, if we don't change our trajectory, towards a likely 4 degrees rise Celsius in temperature. And again, scientists are repeatedly warning us that this will cause unprecedented large-scale disruptions of human and natural systems, food and water insecurity, and just really untold loss of life. And I think this is something that we really need to understand is very serious. And I know, as an example, I'm sitting here in California right now where the weather has been gorgeous. I have access to food and water. I think sometimes it's really difficult for us, unless we are really in an impacted community, to understand how serious this issue really is and is going to impact all of us. Just as another example, we know that from studies that have already been done that with the increase and rise of sea levels, how that can affect the international community is very serious. As an example, for every 1 meter of sea level rise, there will be 100 million people displaced around the world. Just imagine that. That's just meter of sea level rise because of, you know, wherever we live on the coast with sea level rise, people have to move. And imagine 100 million people displaced. You know, where do people go? I did some work for a while in the Maldives Islands, which are the lowest lying geographical islands in the world. And their country, for several years now, has had as a line item in their budget for their entire country, buying a new place to live, to move their entire population to Sri Lanka or India, because once sea level rise to a certain point, they're underwater. Imagine if you have to move your entire country somewhere. So these are the kinds of very serious challenges that we're looking at. And more people who did experience Superstorm Sandy, imagine having that over and over again. And those communities are still not back in order by any stretch of the imagination at all. So we're looking at, you know, national security issues. We're looking at food and water security issues. And right now, the international community is not really poised to be making the level of decisions that we need to be making to really meet the demands that nature is telling us. As the UN Secretary General said at one of the negotiations, I believe it was 2 years ago, nature is not waiting while we negotiate. We really need to step up at speed and scale at this point.
What are women doing about it, and what can women do about it?
Well, I think one of the most important things is, as you're doing here on the show, is first we really need to get educated and understand the time frames that we're operating in and how this is going to affect our children and future generations, and understand that we have a responsibility to act. And, you know, since we're, you know, I do work internationally, but since we're talking here in the United States, I think women need to really understand that there are things that they can do, and to understand that here in the U.S., we're approximately 4% of the world's population, but we emit about 25% of the entire carbon emissions of the whole world are coming out of the U.S. And, you know, what does that mean to us? How can we become more educated about our purchasing power? What does it mean that women control 80% of all the purchasing choices in North America? How can we really mobilize ourselves to understand our choices around energy consumption and consumption in general? And I think this is something that we really need to look at as women in this country, as well as becoming very educated about what our sisters in other countries are experiencing and how our actions affect them. So I think that there's also a wonderful campaign that I just wanted to mention, because it's something that we're very interested in our organization. One of the delegates to the International Women's Earth and Climate Summit in New York is a woman named Natalie Isaacs, who is the co-founder of the 1 Million Women Project in Australia. And it's an Australian-wide campaign of women taking practical action to reduce waste and pollution in their daily lives through household energy, food, fashion, shopping, transport, and travel, pretty much everything that involves their activities. And the campaign is an online campaign that teaches women, you know, where they can make reductions in their homes and make different types of choices. It launched in 2009, and they have 80,000 members now, which I think is just really exciting. You can go online and see how they go about teaching women to do that. And I think that's a very, very interesting campaign and very practical campaign that can be engaged in. There's another project I really, really love is called Solar Sister. And the founder of that is a woman named Catherine Lucy. And it's a very innovative social Enterprise project that is creating a green revolution in Africa powered by women's enterprises. And what Solar Sister does is combine breakthrough potential of micro solar lighting, you know, different solar units that are small, some of them handheld or can be easily transported into rural regions. And what they do is they have a deliberately woman-centered direct sales network. And so it really is a wonderful combination of giving women in rural regions, which are also dealing with poverty, an opportunity to have a business selling these units that are very affordable to light their homes and their communities, while it also gives access to them to providing clean energy so that they can bring in energy into their home, but in a way that is with a simple, clean technology device, while also developing their own businesses as they do so. Really innovative ideas like this, I think, are really very, very exciting. So those are just some examples that we're looking at, and there's many, many others involving agriculture. We know that in Africa and India, you know, the main holders of caring for local green organic food is in the hands of women, protecting their seeds. This is something that women have been doing for hundreds and hundreds of years and are continuing to do so. And we think empowering these women and at our summit, uplifting these solutions and hearing these stories will be a way that women all over the world can really get educated about different ideas about what they could be doing.
Can you contrast, you know, the part, you know, and sort of put them in context with each other, the part played by, you know, the kinds of grassroots solutions that we all can do, pointing out, you know, as you say, that women make 80% of buying choices. You know, how powerful an engine is that versus the sort of overarching infrastructural and policy level decision making? You know, do we need both? How do they interplay? Because, you know, on the one hand, we've been taught, you know, like we've seen in the food movement, which I also cover, you know, the people have been taught that they are making a consumer choice with their pocketbook. They can affect social change by buying healthier foods. But we've also seen top-down policy come through that limits the availability or threatens the availability of healthier foods because of industrial unregulated industrial initiatives, and so we kind of, you know, which therefore remove the consumer choice. So what do you know? So that's like a kind of push-pull. What do you see as the interaction between those levels on climate issues?
Well, I think that's a really great question, and something that you know, I have a personal keen interest in as well, actually. And I think that it's very important to look at both levels. In other words, you know, grassroots movements, what kinds of on the ground solutions we can be implementing, as well as the policy level. And referring earlier to the Women's Climate Action Agenda that we're going to be drafting together at our upcoming summit, the framework that we're operating from is actually twofold. One is looking at on-the-ground solutions as we're talking about, whether that's, you know, our purchasing power or collecting seeds in some countries, or, you know, many of these programs where we can have trainings for women around water solutions and solar solutions. On the other hand, it is absolutely imperative to see that we need movement building around policy, and they do totally go hand in hand. And in our Women's Climate Action Agenda, we have actually two streams that operate throughout the drafting of that program, which are policy level as well as on-the-ground solutions, because they both need to happen, or we don't really have a holistic or full-spectrum approach, which is completely needed at this point. And, you know, just to give you some idea of the kind of work that we're looking at that will be discussed, and we have been looking at different campaigns and different traction points that we think are really important, are, as an example, divestment campaigns from dangerous and dirty fossil fuel developments, which includes coal-fired power plants, oil shale fracking, deep water oil drilling, tar sands, you know, really seeing that these different developments have to stop, and that we also need to put in an immediate end to fossil fuel subsidies, which could change the markets here, not just in the U.S., but around the world, by really creating a level playing field for solar and wind and other clean energy technologies to take hold, and so at a much deeper level than they are. So I think that it's very important to have a very strong position on policy as well as practical on-the-ground solutions, and that they really go together. And this is also why we're bringing all these different women together, because in the long run, we're really trying to grow the global women's movement for climate change action and sustainable solutions, so that we're highlighting solutions, but we're also seeing what are the most important policy solutions that we need to be advocating for, and how can we collaborate at a much more serious level, because no one country can do this alone, no one organization. There needs to be an enormous amount of collaboration, especially around policy issues, to make sure that they are implemented and that we get the proper policies in place. And we're looking both at policies at the United Nations, climate change negotiations with all countries involved, as well as what we can look at in terms of individual policies at the local, national, and international level. Some of the things that we're also really interested in is putting a high price on carbon and implementing carbon fees, looking at financial transaction taxes. There's a lot of very, very interesting policies that I think we need to look at much more seriously and see how we can create a powerful women's movement to demand those policies get into place and that they get implemented. And I think that's something that's also exciting about working in a network of women and being able to create these constituencies with women, is that we've seen what women can do around policy. As an example, in India, one movement that has been a great inspiration to me is the CHIPCO movement, where women who were who very much are dependent on their forests for their livelihoods, stopped the cutting of their forests through creating a movement called the CHIPCO movement. CHIPCO means hugging, and they were the women who hugged the trees, and they wouldn't let, I love that, they wouldn't let the foresters come and cut down the trees, and they created a movement of women who were protecting the trees in this way. We know the suffrage movement in this country, where women gained the right to vote, what happened when women joined forces to do that. We also know that one of the ways nuclear testing stopped in the United States was women around their kitchen table saying, we don't want this to happen anymore. The peace movement in Liberia, peace was attained through women from all different sectors coming together and saying, you know, we are demanding peace in this region. And they pushed the leaders to do so. There's a wonderful film called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is a very strong title about the women's peace movement in Liberia, an extraordinary film documenting the courage and strength of the women in that country to demand peace and their movements and how they went about doing that. So I think one of the big things that we're interested in the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative is movement building, pulling on the fact that women have been incredibly powerful in changing the course of history. And this is the time, given that our children and all life on Earth is being threatened, I can't think of a better time for women to get together and say, you know, we're putting a line in the sand here. Enough is enough. We're not going to continue business as usual. You know, we want a healthy life for our families and for future generations and for the plants and the animals and all of nature. And this is going too far. We have to change our trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very exciting. We're going to come up for the half-hour station break here on Connect the Dots, and we will be back talking with Asriel Oriel-Lake about the International Women's Caucus for Earth and Climate, which you'll be able to learn more about and also find out how to participate in it, which we'll discuss in the second half of the show. So please stay with us on Connect the Dots, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here every week, Wednesdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And today's show, we're talking about what women can do and are doing to address climate change. My guest on the show, if you've listened to the first half hour, is Asprey Oriel Lake. She's the founder and co-director of the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, which is having an upcoming summit September 20th through 23rd in New York State, which you can also participate in via live stream. And there's an exciting gathering, as she told us in the first part of the show, of women leaders, grassroots, and high policy leaders from all over the world who are coming together to assess the ways that they are and can do better collaborating to help stem climate change through women's oriented initiatives. So if you've enjoyed the first half of the show, I'm glad you're back with us. If you're just tuning in, you can find the first half in our archives on Connect the Dots. And please remember to pass the show along to others who may be interested, as well as like us in iTunes. Now, before we delve back into the summit, which is coming up really soon and very exciting event, I just wanted to kind of take a slight detour and talk with Asprey Oriel Lake a little bit about your book. Asprey is the author of a Nautilus Award-winning book called Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature. This is a little bit different, but really core to the spirit of the initiative and all the work and organizing that is happening and that we can all participate in. But here in this book, I think you really go at some of the core new understandings or old understandings that we need to reconnect with, and talking, you know, about sort of how we've gotten to this point, both as countries and also with our as communities and also as part of our own psyches and ways of being. So can you just tell us a little bit about your book and that aspect of it, Asprey?
Sure. You know, in my book, I'm really exploring how we can revitalize a deep relationship with our earth, both from a sensate experience of connecting with nature, but also how we tell our cultural narrative in relationship to the natural world. And so it's actually the core of sort of how I got into the climate movement, actually, is I think, like a lot of people, a deep love for the natural world since my childhood, and really understanding that, you know, our forests and our rivers and our oceans are being threatened right now by the way that we're living as human beings on this planet. And so the book is really an exploration about, you know, how do we change our relationship to nature as modern societies? Right now, over half the world's population lives in urban environments, mostly disconnected from our earth. So, you know, I started asking questions about, you know, how do you care for your rivers, your forests and mountains and other species when you don't really have a connection with them? I mean, we tend to care for the things that we know about and love, and what if we don't have that relationship because we're mostly in these urban environments? So this is something that I think is something that's a really deep, pressing question, and it's something that, you know, I've looked at a lot from a cultural transformation perspective, is sort of the long-term and short-term immediate responses to our different environmental and, you know, crises that we're facing. And I think that, you know, when we're looking at these long-term solutions, a lot of it is about understanding how we have this disconnect from nature. And so my book is really looking at different ways that we can connect, and, you know, how did we get disconnected as modern-day civilizations, and how can we begin to reweave that connection that many indigenous cultures have and still do have with their natural environment, with the ecosystems, and how we need to really understand that our economies, our governments, our governance structures, our consumption patterns all need to really respect natural laws and start becoming much more a culture that is in relationship to versus dominating over the natural world.
That's something I think perhaps that women, and indeed, you know, some men, many men, but certainly not all men, can relate to. Because we are seeing, a lot of the ethos of our society has to do with domination, with winning, with being better than, the idea that, before, as the show was beginning, we were hearing the end of a show with Jim Hightower, who was talking about, an engineered tomato and the notion somehow that that would be better than, an heirloom seed or, a long-term natural tomato of some kind. We have a sense that, sort of an exalted sense that man is better, humankind is better, and yet we're creating these problems. What is the root of that in your sense?
Well, as I say, I think that we've been operating with, a worldview that is, and our cultural narrative and story that's no longer working, which mm-hmm. is one of domination versus relationship. I love the author, Rhian Eisler, who wrote a book called The Chalice and the Blade, and she goes into a deep analysis of, ancient civilizations and looking at how we moved from being, people who are earth-centered and understanding the natural cycles, and as we developed and created different religious viewpoints, different worldviews, we began to really develop this dominator society. And I think that I think also it has to do with the downcasting of feminine values and feminine principles. And I've been engaged with women's leadership and women's empowerment in different capacities over many years, and after studying the oppression of women worldwide and really the rise of patriarchal societies, I think I've come to realize, along with a lot of colleagues, that the long-standing history of violating the earth and violating women is really deeply rooted in the same problem and societal imbalances. So I think to achieve long-term solutions, we really need to deal with root causes and systemic change in our worldviews. And I think this means addressing the silenced voices, and often that is of women and nature. And I would also add indigenous people as well, who have already been living in a balanced and low carbon footprint, if you will, manner with the earth for thousands and thousands of years. And I think we need to lift up these voices if we're going to really see long-term solutions. I just don't think we can ignore the historical and interrelated destructive treatment of both women and nature in our current dominator model societies, and that I think we have to ask the question, how do we reorient the dominant industrialized societies so that they pursue human well-being in a manner that contributes to the health of our family and our children and to our Mother Earth instead of undermining it? And I think all these questions are things that we really need to look at, and I think women and men are engaged in it as well. But I do think at this time women are very well poised to get into these deeper long-term solutions because, as voices that have been oppressed, we have a lot to say. And at the same time, I also think that women have a very unique relationship with nature. I don't think it's better than men's relationship to nature. I just think it's unique, and that mm-hmm. voice of our understanding of the natural world has been missing. And when we begin to allow those voices to be heard, and the voices of indigenous women particularly, to be something that we listen to and respect and adhere mm-hmm. to, that we are going to be far better equipped to rebuild and reweave this connection to nature, our home planet, that we can't live without and that we're part and particle of.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, I hear, here. I completely agree. Well, this is so fascinating. I want to point listeners to this program, to your book again, Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature, for more of this deep analysis. And I also want to point people to the event that we've been discussing throughout the program, which you have founded and co-direct, the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, which is holding an upcoming summit, which is happening from September 20th, a Friday, through September 23rd. And the evening of September 20th, a Friday evening, I just want to point out that there's going to be a wonderful three-way conversation, which I know is going to interest a lot of listeners to this program, with three great women leaders, Vandana Shiva, who you mentioned. I've done articles about her and the GMO movement. She is just, you know, the really, in a sense, the grandmother of global environmentalism. She's fantastic, and she'll be talking with Jane Goodall, and that will be moderated by Amy Goodman. It doesn't really get much better than that.
No, I am so excited about that evening.
I am too, I tell you. I mean, I think it should interest everyone. So I just want to make sure that our listeners know about that evening to tune in. Of course, I'll be reposting this event when it's happening on my Facebook page, and people will, you know, my Facebook followers, legions of you, my friends, can be aware of it, and so can listeners who are following me on Facebook. But I just want to mention, you know, where you go online to get more details about the very fascinating agenda for this conference, which we've touched on, as well as to participate via live stream. So that goes at www.IWECI, that's International Women's Earth Climate Initiative.org /, IWECI -live/stream. And so you'll be able to hear this fascinating dialogue, and I guess it's a trialogue, actually, conversation. But really what's going to be happening overall at the summit, so there will be many, many more things to participate in, take a look at the agenda, and the incredible delegates who are coming from all over the world. But people can also really be part of a conversation, because this is really about conversation, sharing, between and among women to address our biggest challenge. So I urge people to, you know, tune in and get involved and be present for this. What do you foresee, in addition to all of the deepening of wisdom, network, relationship, understanding, sharing of important initiatives and outlooks that will occur at the summit, what are the takeaways that you will be hoping to co-create there and bring forward, in which our listeners can also stay informed about that through your website and participate in it?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I just to say a little bit more about the interactivity of the summit itself. As you mentioned, people can simply go to IWECI.org, and when you go onto our website, you'll see that you actually can participate starting even now. There's something that we have called the Online Solutions Forum, where people can contribute ideas, projects, stories, studies, videos, good practices, recommendations, their solution ideas at this time. So you can enter right now, and what we're going to be doing, and that Online Solutions Forum has been up for about 6 months, and it's been just an amazing format for us to begin to collect all these different ideas from around the world about solutions, and men and women both are putting entries there, everything from on-the-ground solutions, as we were talking about earlier on the program, to policy ideas. And it's if anyone wants some inspiration and is concerned and feeling like, oh, my gosh, climate change and environmental degradation are just so overwhelming, I don't know what to do, go and look at the Online Solutions Forum for inspiration and see the incredible work that's already going on. And granted, we're not winning yet. We just hit 400 parts per million of carbon emissions in the atmosphere a few months ago, so that's not a good sign. On the other hand, I think one of the ways we can buoy ourselves up is to understand that there is a lot of hope out there through these projects. I really encourage people to go to the Online Solutions Forum, and all of those entries will be brought into the plenary sessions of the International Women's Earth and Climate Summit for consideration by the delegates. We will be, you will be able to, as Allison Rose said, you will be able to be involved in the summit proceedings, because it will be live streamed, but there will also be a way for people to comment and to ask questions live. And so we think that's going to be a really great way to have the world community participate with us and understand that they can be a part of the community of building with us what we're calling the Women's Climate Action Agenda, which is to come out of the summit with a very precise agenda of best practices, best policy ideas that we want to begin to implement immediately after in the next year or two to come, the ideas that women are seeing as the most valuable and the most potent right now, where we can get traction as a women's global movement on climate to actually say, you know, these are the ideas that we think really meet the urgency of the time. And then after the summit, there'll be other ways to participate as well. We're not only going to be disseminating this Women Climate Action Agenda and asking others to, of course, collaborate with us to do this. This is not something we can do on our own. No one organization can possibly address this very, very large crisis that we're facing. But we also have something that is going to be a declaration statement, the International Women's Earth and Climate Summit Declaration Statement, which we really want to distribute far and wide, which is basically a sign-on statement that we are wanting to get millions of signatures for, so that as we head into different fora, as an example, one of the most important upcoming UN climate negotiations is in 2015, we'd love to come there with 2 million signatures from women making demands that are much higher than a lot of those negotiations are looking at right now, that really can cut emissions at the level that nature is demanding from us at this point. So there's going to be an opportunity for people to participate in helping us disseminate and sign themselves and bring throughout their organizations this declaration statement. In terms of the program itself, we've posted online, IWECI.org, our agenda, so that people can go and look at the actual agenda hour by hour, and then, you know, have the opportunity to look at the live stream and participate in the portions that they're interested in. So I think it's going to be incredibly dynamic opportunity, and very, very exciting, because we have a planned agenda, but there's also different sections in the program where we're inviting brainstorming sessions, because we know areas, of course, that we really need to focus on that I mentioned earlier in the program, different policies that we think are very, very important, and how we can begin to really create opportunities for those policies to be implemented. And again, a lot of these exciting on-the-ground programs and projects and trainings that we're interested in. But we also know that you bring, you know, 100 different brilliant thinkers together, as we were mentioning, from Vandana Shiva to Jane Goodall to Marina Silva from Brazil, and indigenous leaders and business leaders, and Cristiana Figueres from the UN climate negotiations, and you put them into one space and really say, what can we do? We're very excited about what we don't know. And these brainstorm sessions to see, you know, where is the traction? Where can we be collaborating that we're not? How do we really start winning at a higher level? And I think that's some of the area that I'm most excited about is the unknown, and how can we let some emergent ideas come out of this space.
That sounds really fantastic, because, you know, it's interesting when you said, and I just want to, you know, mention this, when you said that you designed the summit to have a low carbon footprint, and there are people coming together to be there in person, as well as you're making it available via live stream for many more participants. You know, one of the things that I note, and that's I remember I was at a green festival a couple of years back, and I heard David Orr presenting, and he said something about, well, I was really hesitant to fly out here, but I found I could put it together with 6 other activities while I'm here to justify the airfare. And, you know, I mean, as a somewhat newbie to the environmental movement from the health movement, I was amazed to hear that. I never heard that consideration before, and it just struck me so much, you know. And I know so many people, you know, going around, traveling, doing really great things, but, you know, never really thinking through, you know, and very happy to be going here, teaching there, going to this conference or that conference. So, you know, you have really thought that through. You've designed an event that is quite specific, but it's also a rare opportunity, because it's actually quite, you know, it's not that common for indigenous leaders from around the world to join with policymakers and come to an area north of New York City. So, you know, it is a rare opportunity, and kind of and that opportunity is for the meeting and sharing and synergy of different imaginings and creativity. So it sounds like it's going to be a really great event. And I salute you for mentioning, you know, for also designing an event that thinks that through. So because it is a rare thing for people to kind of fly in from these different locations, it is a rare opportunity for that special kind of co-creativity that women, you know, have woven for throughout the millennia and everything. So thank you for that. And there's a way that everyone participating listening to this show, can also participate in it. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm going to be reporting on it. So I'll be, you know, kind of mentioning to people in upcoming shows when I've posted, so you can also look to that reporting as well as participate yourself directly, which I highly encourage. You know, so you're kind of talking about both solutions and also aggregating numbers. You know, do you think there's a way of reaching through and kind of sort of penetrating, waking up, you know, kind of awakening a different viewpoint? What, you know, possibilities? I mean, do you think they're greater than what we tend to let ourselves dream or imagine?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that there is, I think that there's a tremendous movement of people who are waking up that realize, I mean, it's almost hard to imagine that we all wouldn't be more concerned. And the movement building has been amazing. I mean, there's 350.org that has done tremendous work, bringing attention to the climate crisis, nationally and internationally, with a lot of their work around the tar sands campaign and, the Keystone XL pipeline, divestment campaign. There's the Idle No More movement with a lot of indigenous people. There's, you know, Sierra Club's been doing terrific work. I mean, we could go on. There's so many amazing groups involved, Greenpeace, who are really saying, look, you know, we've really got to bring attention to these issues. So there's lots of people involved. I think what we're looking at is, you know, when we look at environmental tipping points, I think we're also looking at movement tipping points. And saying, you know, what is the critical mass of people that we need to really be involved in understanding that we're at a critical time in human history? And it's so big, I think it's hard for a lot of people to grasp, which it is. It's very challenging, but it is time for people to realize that we're in this small window of opportunity to really change our trajectory, especially around climate, but also other issues for our own well-being and the future of the planet. And that's where we are, and I think we just need to keep voicing ourselves, having shows like you're having. I mean, I think it's all of us together. I sort of look at it like when I look at nature as an ecosystem where people are working in many different areas with different solutions, different policies, and it has to work like a healthy ecosystem, everyone doing their part, and that collectiveness of the ecosystem is what's really going to create the breakthrough that we need. And we never know when that moment is, like any social movement that we've studied in history. You don't know if it's that next group or that next meeting or that next policy or the next tree that was planted where you suddenly start changing the trajectory going into the positive direction that we need to go in. And I think that's what we're looking at, is it's a time for everyone to roll up their sleeves and engage in any way that suits them. We all have different things that we feel are compelling, and I think the key is to find the area that we're really passionate about and dig in and get involved. And
so
that's
be part
really
of
that
ecology. Yeah, be part of the ecology that Osprey Oriel Lake is discussing here. Sorry to interrupt you, but we're coming down to the end of our show.
Sorry.
You know, so that's the whole point. Wherever you're working, you can be part of the ecology. This is a great way to connect with the greater ecology of women working toward this end. Thank you so much for being with me today, Osprey Oriel Lake on Connect the Dots. And we're looking forward to the summit. We'll be reporting from it. Please get involved. Please participate via live stream and in advance. Listeners, and thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next week, same time, Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Mama, we're living.